Well, hello, all you wonderful weeds out there. Welcome to another episode of A Little Greener, a podcast all about nature, sustainability, and conservation. I am one of your hosts, Casey, and I'm joined by the magnificent Sarah. Hello.
Hello.
Wonderful weeds. Sarah can attest that I spent there for basically a full minute trying to think of what was a good way to introduce this episode. I started like going into different types of weeds, but then I couldn't match an adjective to it. So here we are. You're wonderful weeds. Weeds is a human-made category. You're all wonderful.
There you go. I was going to say that too. But weeds are what you make of them. Weed doesn't have to equal bad. We'll talk about that a little bit tonight. But it is really funny. It's not like we don't know that this is the intro that we're going to do every time. But the second we hit that record button, it's just like whoever's doing the intro for that day, it's just like mind goes blank. Even if you had thought of something before you hit the record button and it just goes away. So it is.
There's just that like British woman's recorded voice being like, recording in progress.
Yes.
And then it just like,
it's gone.
Silence.
So then we get to sit here staring at each other, like with one person thinking and the other person laughing because they know what's going on in the other person's head. It's great. Good times, good times. How are you doing this week, Casey?
I'm tired.
Yeah.
That's basically a full sentence for me. It was a long day, but overall, the sun has been out longer and the days are getting warmer, and these are good positive trends.
Spring is coming for sure. Yes, that is good news. Although I'm about to travel into colder temperatures, I am excited. I'm going on vacation a couple of days, going up north, gonna get to see some family and some friends. I was gonna say most importantly, not most importantly, but also very fun, a hockey game. That's actually the motivation for my trip, but very excited to see all the people as well. But I am leaving the warm sunshine for colder temperatures, although it's certainly not going to be as cold as it could be at this time of year.
So. Yeah, hopefully it doesn't snow for you, because it's been a like randomly, like it's not comparatively in our whole lives snowy by any means, but compared to the like zero snowfall of last year, it feels very snowy.
Yeah, it's not currently slated to snow in the forecast in any of the cities that I'm going to, but you never know. So we shall see. Casey, I wanted to do a quick challenge update because we forgot to do a challenge update in our last episode.
Yeah.
So I want to kind of rewind to our last two episodes that we've done since your return. Last time you gave us we revisited Green Baby, where you talked about some of the things that you did and didn't do in terms of maybe eco-friendly decisions or plans that you'd made around your first baby. And then prior to that, we chatted along with Kristen about art and conservation, which was a really cool topic that I hope we revisit with more things in the future. And so I wanted to kind of check back in on the challenges that we had for those episodes. I can't even fully remember what the challenges were that we gave during that art episode, except that you talked about getting out and doing it.
Just do art.
Yes, do some art. And then you talked last time about ways that you could kind of reach out if you have people in your community who are getting ready to have just had a baby. And I will say that it just so happened that right after we recorded that episode, I saw a friend and coworker of mine who had had a baby recently. It was my first time seeing her since she had the baby. So it wasn't quite the same as me reaching out, because she actually came and visited at work and had family with her. But it was still really cool to reconnect with her. Like, it made me so happy to see her face and to just be able to directly ask her how she was doing and see the baby and all of that. So that was fun and felt like just a good reminder of how important your challenge actually was. So thank you for that.
I'm glad it was relevant for you, because I did not have the opportunity to do so. But I feel behind. Like, I feel like I'm getting back into the groove of podcasting, and then I have to remind myself to get back into the groove of the challenge as well.
Sure.
I
And
think
as
that's where I'm at. Yeah.
yeah, and as always, it is a thing to have for whenever you need it, sort
Yeah.
of. That's kind of our thought behind these challenges is some weeks are not going to be relevant to you, but now you're aware of it and you will be more aware when there is a time that that challenge is relevant for you. So I need to do more on that, obviously, in that realm of reaching out to people in my community, but it was nice to have that little moment to do so in person. And I did want to mention the art challenge too, because I was struggling with that, especially with you two and your artistic abilities, and just it's just not a thing that I do. But I did, as I was thinking about it, I feel like for me, it's we didn't talk about photography, but I feel
Oh,
like
yeah.
that's my way of doing art with nature. I am not a good photographer. I don't have like professional any type of camera or anything like that. I just have a glorified point and shoot, but I do love to go out there and it does help me be more observant in nature. It's helping me to learn about birds, especially well, I'll take pictures of, but there's no follow-up to that. That was just my thought that I had after considering that episode and feeling like I did not complete that challenge. I was like, well, you know, I did not go out and draw a bird, but I can go out and take pictures of birds.
Totally counts. Totally.
Thanks.
So yeah, and I mean, it really got to the heart of the challenge, which is to utilize some sort of creative expression to connect more with nature. So I think A plus, you did it. I'm proud of you.
Thanks. I needed that. I needed to hear that validation. Appreciate you. All right. Let's anything, do you have anything else to add, whether on challenges or otherwise, before we get started?
I do not. Let's get
Excellent.
started.
Let's do it. All right, Casey. So question this week. I understand that it is winter where you're at, but we haven't talked to you for a few months before this. You've got a new house. We'll still call it new. You've been there a while now,
Yeah.
but what is your gardening situation looking like? What's your lawn and landscaping situation looking like? What's the update on that? Do you have any fun plans in the works?
Oh, we are in full prep mode. I'm
Excellent.
so stoked for spring. The first project that we have coming up is going to be in the front yard. Andrew said for every birthday, anniversary, Christmas, etc. He said a gift could be taking away part of our lawn for
Love
him.
it.
He hates mowing it. So our front yard, we have some pretty decent sized beds kind of in the classic place around the front of the house. But we have a junction of sidewalks where like there's the main sidewalk and then there's a sidewalk that goes to our side door down back to our fence. That's kind of a corner there that seems like an obvious spot to me to start carving away at the lawn. And so I have picked out maybe three or four different native species that we're going to be popping up there. So I'm really excited about that. Because I also work in a garden center, a lot of my winter, when we used to work together, Sarah, I would spend all winter doing fact sheets, if you
Yes,
remember correctly, about
I do.
animals. Yes. And so I'm doing kind of similar projects, but about plants, and I'm learning so much, and it's just so much my jam. So I definitely, that's going to be a big one. And then Andrew, last summer, when we were both on parental leave, he built a little side bed that he then filled with the compost that we had composted like over the last year. And that's going to be an urban veggie garden there. So
Wow, talk about A plus gold star. That is
I'm
amazing.
ready. That honestly, full credit to him because he's been like sticking with it a lot. He loves a good project as well. We're really hampered by the fact that we have a black walnut tree, which is toxic to other plants, that overlaps like half our yard. So it's like shady, wet, and black walnut. So you really are striking out on a lot of options there, but I'm ready for the springtime. I'm ready to plant.
That is awesome. You are like the poster child for every plant-based episode that we've ever done on this podcast. I think you just covered everything.
It means that I don't have to do as much research. I'm also like inspired by my sister-in-law, hi Ariana, who's like transforming their front yard into a mostly native, partially edible landscape. She's super impressive. She's one of those people who's very good at figuring out how to do gardening, like garden hacks on the cheap, figuring out going to plant swaps, participating in native plant programs. So she's kind of the poster child for figuring out how to do this as like a hobby as cheaply as possible. And I'm like so impressed by her.
Man, what have I been doing with my life? Not learning about gardening enough, apparently, because my current situation is that I've done absolutely nothing since way back when last year when you gave us awesome gardening episodes. I mean, I guess I do compost now, but I still don't like have any compost. My bin is finally full, so I'm gonna swap
Nice.
my bins over and hopefully we'll eventually start getting some compost here. But I have done nothing. My beech June sunflower did come back to life, or I mean, probably a new one. It didn't really come back to life. I pulled it out, but it sprouted
It
new ones.
reseeded, yeah.
So there is a new one growing that will probably meet the same fate. But I think I'm going to try putting one in a pot and seeing if I can give it a little more space and keep it alive then. But basically, my lawn is weeds now, like fully. Basically, I mean, there is grass in there, but the grass is not growing right now. The weeds are growing. So literally about 2 hours before we started recording this, I went out and I mowed my weeds. So before I went on vacation so that my neighbors don't absolutely like burn down the house while I'm gone. But yeah, weed control is a thing that I don't do, but that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about weed control in the form of herbicides in particular. We'll talk a little bit about the types of herbicides that you can have. We'll talk about it a little bit in the farming sense, in the residential sense, and see where we go. So stay tuned for a chat about herbicides. All right, thanks for joining us for our discussion on herbicides today. This is, like I said, this is timely for me with my yard full of weeds, but this is also a requested episode. So thank you to Debbie for requesting this. I know it's been a while, so sorry about that. But again, if you're listening and you have an episode idea, we always love to hear them. We'll write them down, we'll save them, we'll store them, and we will get to them eventually, even if it takes us a little while. So thanks for your patience and thanks for the request. So herbicides, Casey, an herbicide is a type of pesticide. That's good to know. I think right off the bat, you'll hear people talk about herbicides and pesticides sometimes. Usually, I think what they mean is herbicides and insecticides. Those are
That's
both
a,
types
yeah.
of pesticides.
Thank you for clarifying that because I was like, really, is it? But
Yeah.
yes, you're right. Pest is really a classification of any sort of living thing we don't like
Yeah. So,
or
like,
want
there's,
in a particular place.
yeah, fungicides too, I think, are usually the three they'll mention as pesticides. Herbicides, insecticides, and fungicides are all.
Do rodenticides count?
Probably, yeah,
Yeah.
I would say so. So, herbicides are a pesticide designed to kill unwanted plants. Like we said in the intro, a weed is a category that we've invented. There's no botanical, right, like scientific definition or distinction that makes anything a weed. A weed is a plant that we don't want where it's at.
Right, exactly. Like a weed is a plant that's growing in a place you don't want it to. And that like definition can change over time, even like I mean, milkweed's a perfect example of something
Right.
we labeled a weed historically, but now people intentionally plant in their gardens. So it depends. I think that there's certain characteristics of weeds that we might think about, like some of them are very viney or thorny, some of them
Fast growing
fast growing, crop up in places where you didn't put them in
plant, yes.
the first place. And sometimes outcompete the plants that you want to be in there. But again, it's whatever you decide you don't want in there. If you think like a rose is a weed, then it's a weed in your yard.
Right. Which is interesting. And I think we'll come back around to that when we talk about herbicides in residential areas, because I think some of the things that are growing in my lawn that I'm calling weeds, I think are actually really pretty, just maybe not all over scattered around haphazardly in my lawn. So we'll come back to that. There are different types and classifications of herbicides that you might come across. So just getting us all on the same page, you might hear about contact or systemic herbicides. So contact herbicides will kill the part of the plant that they come in contact with. I don't know why, Casey, this doesn't make any sense, but the image that came to my mind when I read this was like the Wicked Witch of the West when they throw the water on her and she melts.
She's green too, so
That's, I
that
guess,
makes
I don't
sense
know.
to
That's
me.
what it made me think. But I don't have a corresponding image for the systemic herbicides, which are absorbed and basically destroy the whole plant.
I will
You
give you one.
okay, do it.
Okay, I don't remember his name. Fazzini, maybe, from The Princess Bride, when he drinks the poison in the cup. That's the systemic. They ingest that and then
Okay, that's a good. You so in that way you could make it analogous to poison versus venom too, sort of,
Kinda.
kind
Well,
of.
topical. Yeah, I think there's some sort of connection.
Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
Anyway.
But excellent. You can also have pre-emergent or post-emergent herbicides. So pre-emergent prevents the seeds from germinating. I wrote that, and actually after I wrote that, I learned that maybe that's not always the case. Sometimes the seeds will germinate, but they will prevent them from going further, basically. So,
Yes.
or you'll have post-emergent herbicides that are applied to already growing plants. And then you can have selective and non-selective herbicides. So selective herbicides work on select plants. So certain types of plants. I will say though, you have to understand that this can still be pretty wide ranging. Like they can be selective, but for a very broad category of plants, if that makes sense.
Totally. I was like trying to think of very specific selective herbicides, and my first thought, at least, of like what's on the shelves at our store are like, this is something that kills ivies or
Yeah.
broadleaf plants or
Broadleaf plants is the
mosses.
one I came across most. Yeah. So take selective with a grain of salt, and then non-selective are basically going to kill any plant that they come in contact with. So that's the basics. And then, like I was saying, I feel like this conversation has to have sort of two different segments. So we're going to talk first about herbicides more on the sort of big farm agricultural level, which perhaps is something that you may be seeing or hearing about in the news lately, in particular the herbicide dicamba. This is a word that I have only read and never heard, so I hope that I'm pronouncing that correctly. But we will talk about that. And then we'll have the conversation about weed control at home at the sort of residential or urban level. So, Casey, even though I kind of want to start with the agricultural side of things to get us into it, just general thoughts and opinions on herbicides. Have you ever used chemical herbicides at your house? If you have, how do you feel about it? You do work at a garden center. I presume you have herbicides there. Do you have any sort of general feelings to start us off with?
Yeah, I don't think we've used herbicides at my house, really. I mean, our lawn's in pretty good shape, but we would probably never treat our lawn with any sort of herbicide. That's just like not our bag at all. I would definitely use an herbicide if I had something like poison ivy or an invasive species that was very, very persistent. So there's like certain really thorny briars that invade certain areas around here that is just easiest. Like you can pull them, you can light them on fire.
Yeah.
Like they sometimes need to be killed at the root. And so I would definitely consider it, but I don't think we have any in the house. And that's not something that I would plan to use on a normal basis because we mostly hand pull.
I am mostly the same, although I do have an herbicide of some kind in my house, and I actually. It shows you how much I have used it, I guess. I actually can't even remember what brand or what chemical it is, but I do have one. I have never treated my lawn with herbicides, nor would I. I did buy this for sort of a spot treatment when I had weeds kind of out of control growing in like in my driveway that I
Yeah.
couldn't get out. But I hated doing it
Yeah.
personally, and so it's sort of on hand as an emergency last resort type of situation for me. So that's just kind of personal philosophy. But what I will say that I want to make clear as we start this conversation is I don't think that all use of herbicides is bad. And you can certainly, if you need to use an herbicide, there are still ways that you can do that more positively in terms of thinking about the environment, which we'll talk about. So, herbicides can certainly be convenient and efficient. There's a lot of reasons that people might want or need to use herbicides. Mine was probably a little more time-based. Like I just needed to get this taken care of quickly, and I didn't have time to go out and hand pull a bunch of weeds. But you might also just physically not have the physical ability to be able to get out there and pull them up, especially if you're in a situation where they've sort of gone crazy and you're trying to play catch up. So those are things to keep in mind. Certainly in terms of agriculture and farming, there's a lot, it's a lot less labor intensive to be able to use these herbicides for farmers, especially now with the existence of herbicide-resistant crops. So they certainly can help from a convenience and an efficiency standpoint.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with like the different active ingredients in a lot of herbicides, but like a chemical herbicide is basically any sort of solution that you mix up. So this could be something that is quote unquote organic as well, and it can have similar impacts. But a lot of the like synthetics are the ones that are more potent. And I just kind of want to like put the spectrum out there while we start talking about
No,
it.
that is good. Yeah, we'll talk more about that too as we go along, but that is a good important distinction when we're talking about herbicides. Even when we're talking about chemical herbicides, you can have a natural chemical or you can have a synthetic chemical. And typically, when we're talking, especially on the agricultural side right now, we're talking about a lot of those synthetic herbicides. Herbicides can also be beneficial, or at least, I was going to say used for beneficial purposes. I mean, the intent is that all of this is beneficial, but it can be used to,
Or like ecologically beneficial, not just like aesthetically.
Perfect. So herbicides can be used in particular in the eradication of invasive species, which we've done an episode on before, a couple of episodes, I think, and for, say, restoration of habitat. So if you're trying to get rid of a bunch of stuff that shouldn't be there and then return it to what it was before, herbicides can be helpful in moving those projects along. And also for things like establishing pollinator gardens and meadows and things like that, conservation organizations and individuals who are interested in doing this on their land can use herbicides to help make those projects happen. And they are often, especially if when we're talking about conservation organizations, they're going to use them in times and spaces where other manual methods just would not work, would not be effective. Again, like we were saying before, if something is just really far gone and overtaken or just extremely difficult to get out manually, is when these herbicides can be really helpful.
Yeah, invasive species often take up space in disturbed land, and a lot of like garden beds are in disturbed land, but also lots of roadside habitats, things like that are disturbed land. So there are like categories of weeds that are not just like, we don't want them there. It's like, no, these are also ecologically harmful weeds as well.
So that's all great. The trouble with herbicides comes because of a number of things. Herbicides can be indiscriminate. We are using these herbicides to target these plants that we have decided we don't want in a specific location, or as you just said, are actually damaging. But herbicides can destroy plants that we don't intend them to. And that might mean damaging other crops besides the ones that are being treated, damaging pollinator habitats, damaging natural areas, damaging conservation areas for that matter. So they can be indiscriminate. They can be health hazards. And Casey, we were talking before recording, I don't want to delve too much into this. I just don't feel qualified to speak too much onto it. there's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of information that is certainly spun to one side or the other, especially on certain herbicides. So we're not going to get too deep. That's going to would have to be something that would have much more time devoted to it. What I will personally say for myself, in my opinion, is that it's not something that I think about in terms of the food that I eat, generally speaking. Again, when I'm thinking about agricultural use of herbicides, the part that I think a little more about is more of the manufacturer and application side of things for these health risks, not so much the food that I eat. Again, that is just my thought and opinion based on what I know, but we won't get into too much of that tonight.
Wash your fruits and
Yeah.
vegetables when they come home. That's going to do the vast majority of the work. You're right. Like the people who are actually applying the chemicals are the ones that are getting like much higher dosage
Right.
than we would as the end consumer. And like it's important to think about people who work on farms oftentimes are people who are under-resourced or are migrant workers and things like that. So it's important that whatever we're using, that people have the proper protections to make sure that doesn't impact their health. But yeah, it's a minefield
It
down
is.
there. There's studies, there's court cases. So if we ever decided to tackle anything adjacent to this, I think it would deserve its own episode. But it
For sure.
is certainly something to say that like this is plant poison that we're putting out. That's the point. So yeah, how are we using it and how would that trickle into other parts of the ecosystem, including humans?
Yes, but that is a potential thing that is out there in terms of risks for herbicides. And then, as we've said, they can be environmentally damaging as well, whether that's talking about habitat loss for pollinators. We see runoff leading to algal blooms. There are studies showing that herbicides can be damaging for soil invertebrates that are essential for healthy soils. So, a lot of potential impacts that we need to think about when it comes to our herbicide use. So, let's talk about the use of herbicides in farming over the years. So, of course, when humans first started growing food to eat, we used mechanical means of weed control, whether that is hand pulling or plowing. And then we also developed those sort of natural herbicides that we alluded to earlier. So salt can be used
Yeah.
as an herbicide, sulfuric acid can be used as an herbicide. And I do want to say that a natural herbicide does not necessarily equal good or safe. If you're putting salt down on your soil all the time, that's not good for the soil in the long run.
Yeah, super important to put out there. I mean, it's like the same thing of like even organically derived products can still be poisonous. There's
Yes.
plenty of organic poisons out there. You shouldn't eat every plant out there, even if it's organic. And so, yeah, we'll talk a little bit more about the salt thing a little bit later because I have some thoughts about like home remedies as well. But I've done a lot of hand pulling of weeds in my life. It's intense. It was a punishment when I was a kid, but also a part of my job now. So it's like not, it is very labor intensive. And if your food is dependent on you doing that, like that it is a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I did some hand pulling again today after I mowed the weeds in my lawn. I did some hand pulling of the weeds in my walkway and driveway. And yeah, that is such a small area, but it's hard work. I can't imagine hand pulling all of the weeds and all of my crops if I were a farmer. So
Acres and
yeah,
acres.
right. No, thank you. In the United States and Canada, there were a few, quote, extension type publications that were published in the late 1800s, but that started to increase. This information on weeds and managing weeds really started to increase in the 1900s. And then in the early 1900s, both mechanical weed control methods and research on inorganic weed control increased for the first few decades up through the 1940s. And the 1940s is when we got the discovery of 2,4-dichlorophenoxal acetic acid, or something like that, which is also called 2,4-D. That is a pretty common herbicide still used in agriculture today. So I wanted to mention that one. And then in and after the 1950s, things for inorganic herbicides sort of took off. So there were a lot more studies, there was a lot more availability of herbicides, awareness of herbicides in general public, and all of that. I was reading an article called "A History of Weed Control in the United States and Canada." Perfect.
Yeah.
I wanted to share a few things from that. Again, all of our resources and things that we mentioned along the way will be in our show notes, so you can check those out if you want to see the whole thing. But according to this publication, the number of herbicides in general use in the United States and Canada increased from 15 in 1940 to 25 in 1950. And then by 1969, it was 100. There were 100
Whoa.
herbicides available. The total support for weed research in 1962 in the United States was 6 times what it was in 1950, and the number of full-time research and extension workers, or their equivalents in part-time workers, had increased 20-fold and 13-fold, respectively, over that number in 1940. So just a big weed control boom in the 1950s. It sounds like this really became a thing that people started to care more about, be more aware of, and then have more options available to them. Nowadays, things have kind of slowed down a little bit. There have been no new methods of herbicide action. So, not that there have been no new herbicides, but no new ways developed to kill plants, like new mechanisms, since the 1980s.
It's so interesting. Like, there's a certain point. I feel like, I mean, it's kind of like antibiotics, where we accelerated the development of antibiotics, and then after a while, we were like, yeah, we got enough, and then we kind of stopped.
Well, and it's not so, I mean, we'll talk here very shortly about like a development that was made for an herbicide that I hope I say this clearly and correctly, that changed the way that that herbicide was able to act. But it was not a new way for herbicides overall to act, if that makes sense. So we're still kind of developing new things. It's just the mechanisms
Okay.
that we're like, all right, we've figured out all the ways that we know how to disrupt plant growth, maybe. So anyway, the other sort of piece of this is we have all of these herbicides, and we now have herbicide-resistant crops to go along with that, right? So now more than 90% of our corn, cotton, and soybeans that are planted in the United States are herbicide resistant crops, which means that it is easier for farmers to just spray this herbicide over things because it's going to get theoretically the things that they want it to get, and it is not going to destroy their crops because they have been modified to be resistant. So the example that I feel most people have heard of is we're aware of the herbicide Roundup, which is glyphosate, and then we've got Roundup Ready crops is what they're called. You can have Roundup Ready corn or soybeans.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this a little bit later, but like, this to me is the biggest PR disaster for GMOs. So, like, a lot of these crops were genetically modified, like a GMO, genetically modified organism, to be resistant to the earth's herbicides. And like, agriculturally, that's a game changer because you could potentially produce so much more with, less labor maybe in trying to make sure you're only spraying the weeds. But like, there is huge impacts to spraying things like Roundup over everything. And so this year just introduced the first GMO tomato to direct co to consumers. So for a while, GMOs were mostly isolated to big business that have patented them, and they're
I
just
see what you're
using them
saying. Yeah.
specifically. They, you know, have farmers buy the seeds from them. They're patented. They belong to them. And now they've used a GMO tomato where they've taken a gene from a snapdragon and they've put it in tomato to make the tomato purple. And so it has anthocyanins, which theoretically have more health benefits. And I feel like we're in a place where if we hadn't used GMOs to indiscriminately spray herbicides on everything, that like we might be open to it. Like, you know, CRISPR technology is new, and like we're talking about gene editing to help with diseases and cancer. And so I feel like if we didn't associate GMO with chemical and like frankenfoods, that we might be in a place where more people would be open to this purple tomato that could
Yeah.
potentially, you know, I don't want to say whether or not it actually is healthier,
Sure.
but like theoretically, you could change foods to be healthier. And but everyone just thinks of like Roundup Ready crops, and that's a PR nightmare, in my opinion, for
I
GMOs.
guess maybe. I don't know. It's GMOs would need its a whole other episode.
Yes.
I will say it doesn't bother me yet, personally. I don't have
I don't.
we'll talk about it later.
Yes. I have a bigger issue with the corporate monopolization of GMOs and then how they're like the Roundup
Sure.
Ready crops than I do about the
Yes.
actual like creation of them. We cultivate foods. Anyway.
Yes, I think we're likely relatively on the same page, but maybe you guys will hear about that in a different episode someday. All right, Casey, let us get back to our herbicides and agriculture. There are a handful of top used herbicides in agriculture, and I'm mostly speaking about the United States here, but glyphosate is the one people are probably most familiar with. That is Roundup. That is the most, and that I should say, that is, you could have many herbicides. Roundup is probably the most popular brand name, I
Famous,
would say, that
maybe.
yes, yeah, most famous brand name that people would use. But glyphosate is the most commonly used herbicide in the United States.
Yeah, you can think about it like ChapStick versus lip
Yes.
balm. It's just the brand name on it. I would say our garden center stopped carrying Roundup maybe almost 10 years ago now, because of some of the reported issues concerning human health associated with it. But it was the most popular herbicide. It was like the first one on the shelf. People grabbed it off. There was like four different types.
Yeah.
And it's because it was very, very, very effective. I say was because we don't carry it and I haven't touched the stuff in a long, long time. I think about sometimes though, like my grandfather and my dad, who have been at the store for a really long time and have gone through every iteration of herbicide and pesticide that has been commercially available over time, and like the things that now we're like, wow, we don't use that anymore because it's not worth the risks, has just been out there.
Yeah. Some other ones that are big in the United States, atrazine, that 2,4-D that I
Yeah.
mentioned that was discovered back in the 1940s, that's still a big one. And then dicamba is another one of the top ones used in the United States. And Casey, you mentioned in our last episode that you have been less in touch with the news since baby than you were before, which is very understandable, and I think probably a positive development. But with
Probably.
that, have you seen or heard anything that's been going on with dicamba in the news lately? Is this something you're familiar with?
Not really, but when I read this outline, I'm like, oh, so this is probably the comment that my mom made about some sort of hormone issue with a pest or herbicide treating the crops that grow Cheerios. And so I think that my mom had like sort of side mentioned it to Andrew, and he brought it up as our daughter's eating Cheerios, and I'm like, thank you for planting that little tidbit. But that's the only like even hint of what I've heard about it.
Gotcha. Once again, yeah, I'm not gonna to go down that side of things in terms of any potential health impacts, but it has been in the news lately because of some, I guess, regulations that have been overturned recently about the use of this particular herbicide. So again, dicamba has been in use for decades as a pre-emergent herbicide. So again, like we talked about in the beginning, this is typically used to disrupt seed germination or shortly after germination to actually keep that weed from growing. In 2015, Monsanto developed dicamba-resistant crops, and then in the years following that, an over-the-top, which just means like that's how it's applied, like sprayed from up above, dicamba products were developed. So basically, we now have a post-emergent form of dicamba that was available for use for farmers. In 2022, that usage was blocked. Sorry, not in 2022. In 2020, that usage was blocked temporarily and then reauthorized with some different restrictions later in that same year. So we had this one version of this product that had been used for a long time. We then developed resistant crops so that we were then able to use this herbicide in a new way. Then there were concerns about this usage of dicamba as a post-emergent herbicide. Primarily, drift was the issue. The big issue with dicamba is that it is prone to spreading well beyond the intended area and causing damage to other plants. Whether, once again, that is other neighboring crops that are not resistant to this herbicide, or whether that's wild spaces and habitats. So that was the issue in 2020. Usage was stopped. They came back and said, well, we've made some changes. We fixed it. It's better now. Usage was started up again. And then just weeks ago, once again, usage of this over-the-top post-emergent dicamba has been stopped. So a federal court has overturned the EPA's approval of these products, determining that the EPA violated the federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act's public input requirement before its approval. So basically, they said that the EPA just did not follow the proper procedures in getting these products approved. So this does not say that we can't use the herbicide dicamba, but it is blocking those post-emergent over-the-top spray-on applications of dicamba products. And that is what has been all over the news. There was question about, I guess, I'm not a farmer, but part of the issue being that farmers have largely already ordered, already planned their crops, already bought their seeds. And so if farmers now have these orders of dicamba-resistant crops that they're planting, and that was their plan, what are they going to do? So they have granted that things that have already that were already like in the process of being like left the manufacturer in the process of being sold or whatever, going down the supply chain, those can be used this year. But after that, they will no longer be able to be used. So that's the current situation with that particular herbicide and why you're seeing it in the news right now.
When you start impacting farmers, like there's a lot of trickle down because it is our national food supply. And so they're a pretty politically powerful group because we depend on them for being able to feed ourselves and our pets and our livestock.
And it was interesting to read about because there was just concern, I feel like, on all sides, because some of the people that were concerned about dicamba were farmers saying, hey, like my crops are being harmed by this drift from this other field, you know, down the way. So that was interesting. And then, yeah, just reading about the kind of supply chain and the concern for this year's crops and the planning that it takes. I mean, it would be hard to be a farmer, man, and to figure out like how to manage all of this. So I think it is a tough gig for them. And I don't know, after reading through all of this, you know, we would all love to say We don't want to have chemical herbicides sprayed on our crops. We don't live in a perfect world. I don't think that we can eliminate chemical herbicides, but I think the idea, we've talked about regenerative farming on the podcast before. Kristen's talked about it with her work in the Soil and Conservation District. Soil and Water Conservation District. We talked about the Netflix movie. The name just flew out of my brain.
Kiss the
Kiss the
ground.
ground. That's what it was. Yeah. So we talked about it a little bit there. And I just think that idea of integrated weed management moving forward is the direction that we need to move. But it is just kind of interesting to follow this dicamba case. I'll have a link in the show notes to a more complete, it was a very complicated back and forth timeline, but I do think it is also important to be really thoughtful about what products we're using and really making sure that we're addressing all areas of safety for the people, the food supply, and the environment when we are approving these herbicides.
I think we're moving in a like cognitively better direction anyway, because the things like I was just reading a paper about monarch populations and historical decline of monarch populations might be largely attributed to agricultural practices of applying herbicides and killing specifically milkweed, which is the only host plant for monarchs. And I think we have enough public awareness now of the plight of the monarch and how ecosystems are all related to each other. We have the whole DDT with pesticides getting into our water streams that people are more aware of that broader implications of them. So I think we'll see continuing improvement in that, especially if we keep that public pressure.
All right, Casey, you want to go ahead and switch over to talk a little bit about herbicides in residential areas now?
Yeah, let's do it.
I think the thing about this is sometimes people, I mean, you just talked about the increasing awareness and things like that. I do think maybe sometimes people might view herbicides in particular as a farming issue and not really think so much about their own use of a weed killer in their flower garden or in their front yard, or not really think about that as being an environmental issue at all. So, this may be a terrible question, but in your mind, when you think about herbicides in urban or residential areas, are there any particular thoughts or concerns that spring to mind for you? What would you tell somebody that didn't think that it mattered?
Well, the first thing I tell customers who are buying an herbicide is use as directed on the back of the bottle, because that's actually the thing that concerns me most, is that we have this, you've got this spray bottle in your hand, and there is such a desire to just spray as much as possible. And if you read the directions on these, there are specific times to apply them. There's certain weather conditions you should be cognizant of. And then there's certain application rates where you should wait a certain amount of time in between applications. But if you take a look at this weed that hasn't died after your first, you're watching it grow in your sidewalk, and 4 days after you applied the first round, even if you have to wait, you're supposed to wait 2 weeks in between for that particular product, you want to spray it again. And so for a farmer, this is a economic input. They're not going to try and spend more money on an herbicide than they think is necessary to get rid of the weeds. For the homeowner, they just have a spray bottle in their hand. There's no like giant economic incentive to be very conservative with how you use this or only use when necessary. I do think, again, public opinion has shifted, but that's my number one thing I tell people is like, read the bottle. Be careful.
Yes, follow the bottle. Absolutely. And I think that is exactly right. I also chatted with Kristen about this. If y'all are listening to this episode for the first time, our friend Kristen works for her local Soil and Water Conservation District. She guest co-hosted for months last summer on the podcast. And I asked her, I was like, hey, we're talking about herbicides this week. Don't do any work, don't do any research, but just from your job, what is the thing that you would want people to know? And she did talk a little bit about their use of herbicides in restoration projects, but also the number one thing was to use the right chemical at the right rate and the right time. Follow the instructions. It is so important because those instructions not only, I mean, that's how the product is supposed to work, but they are trying to mitigate some of those other environmental impacts. So follow the instructions, follow the instructions, follow the instructions. And
Yeah.
I'll have a link to a document, but also a YouTube video of a talk from the Xerces Society, which is a great pollinator conservation organization. They had a fantastic resource on herbicides. And they talk about how, kind of just what you were saying, Casey, while in urban areas, herbicides are generally applied to smaller areas, they are often applied more frequently and abundantly. And they say that more pesticides are used per acre in urban areas as compared to many agricultural areas,
Ugh.
even though total herbicide use is higher in agriculture. So, I mean, that's basically what you were getting at, Casey. And then they also said that those pre-mixed products that you can buy for home use will often contain a higher herbicide concentration than those that are used in those agricultural settings, too. So don't think
Yeah.
that the stuff that you have in your bottle isn't doing anything. It all adds up.
I mean, and that makes sense from a commercial standpoint, is that like that's the reason people love Roundup, is that they're like, it turned brown immediately. It's like, yeah,
Yes.
right. Did it have to turn brown immediately? Could we have accepted maybe multiple uses at the cost of whatever it was killing down in the soil? Like, there's the potency of the herbicide could make it so that you can't plant successfully in that same spot that weed was in because of the
Yeah.
residual in the soil. So, like, you might be working against yourself if you don't have the patience to.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do know that this has environmental impacts as well. Again, especially if you're not using it appropriately, this can stay in the soil, it'll be damaging to the soil. We also know that it can run off into our waterways. In a study from 2021, the United States Geological Survey found pesticides. So, again, that is including the whole lump sum, but herbicides included in these pesticides. But this study found pesticides in 96% of urban streams. So, the stuff is out there. It's if you're spraying it outside, it's going somewhere. So, just be mindful of that as you're thinking about weed control in your own lawn. So, with that said, how do we cut down on herbicide use? So, Casey, we've talked about that we don't really put herbicides on our lawns. Have you ever tried any sort of homemade weed control or have any insider plant information that you want to share with us about some of these homemade ideas that are out there?
So, yes, Andrew has put together what I would consider the most classic homemade weed control, which is a vinegar, Epsom salt, Dawn dish soap solution. I remember him being frustrated how slowly the weeds died. It
Yeah.
wasn't like as effective. Some of these products and like this solution will like brown out the foliage, but it won't necessarily kill the root. And that's where a lot of people get frustrated, is like there's the root underneath. Sometimes you have to be able to pull up the taproot. I did a little bit of research because within like Garden Center Facebook groups that I'm in, some people joke a little bit about this being like a little bit of a myth. Vinegar, the reason people feel comfortable with it is because we have it in our kitchen, and when you do put it in the environment, it does dissolve and dissipate quickly. But the strength of the vinegar that's necessary to kill the plant effectively is a way higher concentration than you're going to get out of your kitchen vinegar.
Yes. And so you have to like keep safety in mind with that
Right.
too, if that's the direction you want to go.
Absolutely. And like start to think cognitively about like, why are you comfortable with an extremely like potent vinegar, which is still a chemical. Like, you know, the word chemical, your apple is made of chemicals. Like, it's just, it's a very broad classification, even though it's kind of an ugly word. why are you comfortable with maybe that versus an herbicide that has been tested, or there are organic herbicides, there are inorganic herbicides. The salt is actually the bigger issue, because if you pour a bunch of salt onto a plant, yes, it will die, but so will a lot of the soil microbes that are in that area, and you're just kind of poisoning your own soil. So that actually stays in the environment and can have longer term effects. So when I Googled just to like try and find an official resource for this, it was hilarious because every other article was like, why this doesn't work, why you should try this, why this might not be effective, why you're doing it wrong, this is a great way to avoid chemicals. So it's all over the place. I did find a source I'll put in the show notes that's from the USDA discussing, again, that potency and some of the risks that might come with the vinegar solution. We have done it. To me, there are not a lot of places in my yard. I think Andrew treated something in between two pieces of sidewalk. That was like the issue. So I've tried it. I don't know if it's something that I'd really recommend to people, because I don't think that it's accomplishing what they want. I don't think it's as effective as they want it to be, and I don't think it's as safe as they want it to be.
I 100% agree, and I trust your opinion on anything plant more than my own. But from the research that I did for this episode as well, that is where I landed. Look, if there were a safe, easily available at home, effective spray on weed control method,
They would sell it.
everybody would be using it.
Right.
It would be widely available. I dish, like, I've seen people say that, oh, you just spray dish soap and water. Soap doesn't kill weeds. Soap can be a component of,
Right.
as you just said, but you're using it along with the vinegar. That's what's actually killing the plant. The soap is like a, I don't know the appropriate terminology, but it helps like transport it, I guess, or
Oh,
whatever.
sure. Yeah, it's like a broadcast.
Yeah, but it's not actually doing the killing. So there is a lot of misinformation out there. Anything that I could find tied into any reliable source, like I'll be sharing some from the University of California, basically said that there is some efficacy in things like, what is it, acetic acid? Is that what's the in the vinegar
I
that
think
is
so,
doing it?
yeah.
But as you said, a much higher concentration than what you're going to find in household vinegar. And even then, it is not as effective as
Right.
these synthetic
I think what I
herbicides.
read is that it's more effective towards like an annual weed that might pop up from a seed versus
Correct.
something with like a thistle that has a taproot to it. Like, it's not going to kill the taproot and you're just going to keep pouring salt into the soil. But like, it could be effective towards certain types of weeds. So, like, one of the things you can do is try and identify actually what kind of weeds you have. And then look up the best ways to kill that particular weed so that you can be more selective and you can potentially use less of a broad spectrum product. You know, kind of the best ways to utilize it against that particular type of plant.
One of the resources I'll share from the University of California has a list of some of those
Cool.
things too. Yeah. So I would say for us in our residential areas, there's a few things that we can do. One of them is changing our mindset on how our lawn should look. And I've just asked myself if I didn't have a neighbor who I'm so thankful, like my neighbors do not seem to have a problem with my lawn. I've chatted with my one neighbor who does have your more typical manicured lawn. And when it came up, he was like, oh, it's fine. Like, I just let people do what they want to do. He does also have a trench in between our yards, rightfully so. It was there before me. So
Okay, so it's not in
he didn't
response
build
to
it
you.
because of me. No. But he's probably real glad he has it now. But so he's very nice about it. But I ask myself, if I wasn't surrounded by other people in this neighborhood, would I care as much if my lawn looked like this? And I think the answer is no. I'm just like conditioned to think that this is how a lawn should look. This is how the other, because I do, like, I see his lawn and I'm like, oh my gosh, his lawn looks so much prettier than mine, even though I know that lawns are not a good habitat for anything. It's still, there's still just something about it that I think makes it a lot of people think that it's desirable.
I mean, I think a well-manicured lawn can be attractive. It's like a solid, beautiful, lustrous color. It's a place for your eye to rest amongst the landscape. But as we've talked about many times, kill your lawn because the maintenance required from the carbon emissions from the mower to the insecticides and the herbicides that you might have to apply, like the resource intensiveness of this, like not drought tolerant, like water consuming biological desert is not worth spraying anything
But
on it.
again, like I think, that this has just come to be our cultural norm here.
Right.
And so I think we just need to start shifting that in our brains a little bit. It is okay. These, like I said, these weeds that are in my yard are pretty if you look at them by themselves. I've got these little yellow and white flowers. I've got these little pink and purple flowers. I felt so bad as I was mowing today because I'm seeing the little bees fly away. And I'm just like, oh, I'm sorry. I'll leave you some. They'll be back soon. So yeah, I think just starting to change our mindset is important.
Along those lines, on my bone to pick with kind of the way we operate with that is the rise of homeowners associations as
Oh.
well. There's some study that showed how many more new housing developments are operating under homeowners associations. There's a lot of problems with homeowners associations, but we come in contact with them a lot as like a landscape design firm. And they are so aesthetics oriented versus like science oriented. Like they often require their houses to have dyed mulch, even though that's not the most beneficial for the soil. They will use the dues for the HOA to pay for lawn care services that include broad spectrum herbicides and insecticides. So, if you do live in a community with an HOA, like there should be some sort of voting board about some of the restrictions that they apply. If there is a service that applies herbicides, like start kind of investigating that a little bit more because that doesn't have to be the way that it is. And I think more and more people are looking for, like, some of these HOAs are like, you can't have a bird feeder in your yard. And these are the 10 types of trees you're allowed to plant. Like, it's just not, it's so aesthetics and maintenance oriented versus anything to do with biology.
Yeah.
Off my soapbox now.
It is a struggle for sure. Again, I'm grateful that I do have an HOA, but it is very minimal and I don't have any issues with that. The other things that you can do in terms of weed control in your own yard, just really
Pull them
try to
out.
get in the habit of mechanical weed control.
And some of them, it is the most effective way. Like it's super annoying, but it can be the most effective way for some of those weeds.
Yeah. So
If you're
listen,
able.
this yeah, exactly. And recognizing that that is a challenge. But if you're like me and you just don't like doing it, there is just a mindset shift there that has to happen that I'm going to need to go out and regularly pull the weeds in my walkway. And that's just a thing that I'm going to have to get used to. It's not really that bad once I'm out there doing it. I don't go to all the trouble of yanking them up by the roots, so I know they're gonna come back, but it's you got to do what you got to do sometimes. And this is that Xerces Society webinar that I mentioned. This is their recommendation for homeowners as well, where they talk more on the agricultural side. They do talk integrated management with the use of herbicides for residential areas. They do really recommend trying to skip the herbicides altogether and go for that mechanical control. But once again, if you do need to use a chemical herbicide, follow the directions, make sure that you're using it correctly, and do try to identify the specific weed and make sure that you're finding the right chemical for you. It's probably not what you wanted to hear. I wish that I had a silver bullet for your weed control or that I had found some really amazing secret, safe, natural thing that you have in your kitchen cabinet, but it just isn't out there yet. So
Sorry.
kill your lawn,
Kill your lawn, pull your weeds.
grow some wildflowers
It's your
for your weeds.
gym.
Yeah, exactly. Get your arm workout. All right, Casey, thanks for this discussion. I love doing plant things because I know that you're just going to have so much more information to add, and that makes it a lot of fun. So thanks for your input.
I was like, I have so many more thoughts on different topics related to this. Are we going to become a gardening podcast? I was like, no. We'll swing into conservation soon. But there's so many related topics that are very like a little greener
Yeah.
opportunities that we'll definitely be covering lots of different.
Well, there's time. We got time. We'll write them
Yes.
all down. All right. So thanks for listening, everybody. Hope you enjoyed that. Stick around. We will be right back in just a moment with your challenges for the week. All right, welcome back. Thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks, Casey, once again for your discussion. I know we say this all the time. I really need to get better at my challenges. I feel like I am just going too broad and too numerous with challenges. But it's just depending on where you're at, there are maybe multiple things that you could do. So I would say, overall, your challenge is to, how do I want to put this? Think about the ways that you could get more involved in cutting down on herbicides. So whether that is your own personal lawn management, maybe you're going to skip a spray and go out and pull some weeds. Maybe you're going to dedicate an area of your lawn that you're going to convert over to pollinator habitat. Or maybe your thing is to get more involved in what's going on in your local agriculture. So maybe you can get involved in your own soil and water conservation district. Maybe you can check out and see what the farmers in your area think about this dicamba issue. Just think about a way that you can get yourself more invested in this topic. Does that make sense?
I think so. I mean, we've talked about it before. Everybody's got their own little corner of somewhere. So if you've got a yard, that's an easy place to start. But if you don't, there are community gardens and parks. And I don't know if you're a member of a golf course, talk to them about it. Like there's places that you might be affiliated with, your church or synagogue or temple. How are they handling their grounds? There's the school, your workplace. You have an avenue that and connection to the land, even if you don't have like an actual piece of it, that you can just start looking at how we manage that, because I think a lot of it goes unseen.
I will also, on a more specific note, I'll be sharing what is called the bee precaution tool from the University of California. This was another thing recommended by the Xerces Society, and it has different ratings for different herbicides in terms of their effects. As it's called bee precaution, it's really talking about bee species, but that is maybe kind of a good reference point for you to get started. If you are having to use a chemical herbicide, this might help direct you in which way to go. And it was kind of interesting. I was just putting some different names in that I was aware of, and it was fun to see what popped up. So I'll be sharing that, and that's something that you can look at too. So if you've got an herbicide sitting in your garage right now, you can pop it in and see what it says.
Thank you, Sarah, for tackling this listener requested topic. Definitely one that I enjoyed talking about with you. So, if they want to request another topic or give us feedback or personal stories about herbicide use, where can the lovely listeners, those w wonderful weeds, find us?
Well, I feel like the number of places is dwindling, unfortunately.
Oh, yeah, we got locked out of our Instagram account real quick. That's
My
our
bad.
bad.
My
Yeah, no,
bad.
that's it'll come back.
Yeah, we'll figure it out
It'll happen.
eventually. So just that's why there's radio silence on Instagram right now. So maybe don't message us there for the
Don't do
moment. But
that.
you can find us still on Facebook at A Little Greener Podcast. You can look for us there. You can also email us at alittlegreenerpodcast@gmail.com. And we are always happy to hear from you. So, questions, comments, other episode suggestions, whatever you like.
Thanks for listening, guys. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.
Bye.